Good morning. Welcome to Focus 580. This is our morning talk program. My name is David Inge, and we are very glad to have you with us as we begin another week's worth of programs. If you take a look at many of the emerging infectious diseases that cause concern in the world today, you can see that there is one thing, at least, that they have in common, and that is that they can be transmitted from animals to humans. And if we want to limit their spread and try to monitor the spread of these diseases, it makes it very important that two kinds of doctors, those who treat humans and those who treat other kind of animals, work together and talk to one another and communicate what it is that they are encountering as they deal with their patients. Well, this morning we'll be talking about what is actually an effort to return to an earlier model of medicine. And if you go back into the history of medicine a few hundred years, you see that there was not the clear division that we have today between those doctors who work with humans and doctors who work with other animals. There are people that argue that maybe it wouldn't be an idea if we returned to that earlier kind of way of thinking about medicine, that there aren't two kinds of medicine, but basically there was only one kind of medicine, and just maybe the patients differ a little bit. And that indeed, if we are to try to effectively monitor and control these kinds of diseases that we're talking about, that kind of cooperation between these various kind of doctors is going to be very important. We have two guests joining us this morning, and they are both with us on the telephone. Dr. Laura Kahn is an internist, and she's also a member of the research staff at the Program on Science and Global Security at the Woodrow Wilson School of Public and International Affairs at Princeton University. Also joining us is Dr. John Herman. He is a veterinarian. He's a doctor of veterinary medicine here at the University of Illinois and has been here on the faculty since 2004. And one of the things that he's been involved with here at the University of Illinois is developing a kind of a program that would move us a little more in that direction of getting together these various kinds of doctors. And in fact, both of them were involved in a kind of a conference, a colloquium that took place earlier this month on the U of I campus, titled One Medicine, the Interface of Human, Animal, and Public Health. So as we talk with the guests about some of these subjects, certainly people who are listening can call in with questions. And they're the only thing we ask of callers is that people are brief, and we just ask that so that we can keep the program moving along, get in as many different people as possible. But certainly, people who are listening can call with questions. Here in Champaign-Urbana, if you're here, where we are, the number to call is 333-9455. We do also have a toll-free line, and that one's good anywhere that you can hear us. And that is 800-222-9455. So 333-WILL, if that makes it an easier, and toll-free 800-222-WILL. Well, Dr. Kahn, hello.
Hello.
And Dr. Herman, hello.
Hi.
Thanks to both of you for talking with us. We certainly appreciate it. And maybe first the thing to do would be to talk a little bit about this this long list of diseases. And actually, once you start listing them, you see that the list is pretty long, and some of them are emergent in the sense that they're things that we have become concerned about in the relatively recent past. But some of them also are diseases that human beings have been living with and have caused significant outbreaks of disease for a long time and going back in history. So I don't know who. Maybe I'll ask Dr. Kahn. Just tick off a few of these diseases that we're talking about.
Well, HIV/AIDS to start is a zoonotic disease. Now, zoonotic means it's a disease from animals that can infect humans. Mm-hmm. So that, avian influenza, SARS, Nipah virus, Hendra virus, West Nile virus, you know, there's a lot of them.
Yeah, bubonic plague is one if you go back into history.
Right, if you go back through history.
Rabies is one of them. So
rabies, anthrax, plague, as you mentioned. You know, there's a lot.
So, and a lot of these are things that have been problems with human health and have to do with the fact that, and perhaps more in the past than in the present, but that people do live closely with animals. Sometimes they have contact with wild animals, but certainly they have contact with their domestic animals.
Certainly.
And it is as much as possible for that to happen with wild animals or domestic animals. And I guess another thing you'd point to being a very old kind of animal-human disease connection is influenza.
Right.
Probably that's a disease that human beings have been dealing with for a long, long time.
Mm-hmm.
Well, maybe Dr. Herman, you want to jump in here and add anything on?
Yeah, there's we covered mostly viruses just there, but there's a whole bunch of foodborne illnesses, primarily bacterial, that we really didn't recognize as being major problems even 20 years ago. The enteropathogenic E. coli, Shigella, Campylobacter, all those things that are coming to the fore. Norovirus, Norwalk virus. There was just another report of that down in a hotel, I think it was in New Orleans, just yesterday or the day before. We see a lot of old diseases coming back and reemerging, and new ones cropping up.
Mm-hmm. It seems to be the case often that diseases, various kinds of disease-causing organisms, are adapted to specific hosts. And there are certainly cases where I'm sure that there are animal diseases that affect those animals, those particular animals, but don't make the jump to humans. Humans can't get them. And it goes the other way, too. I'm sure that there are human diseases that animals can't get. What makes the difference between something that is very specifically adapted to its host, or maybe it's something where the host animal can get it, but it's not going to be fatal, but if a human gets it, then it can be a much more serious problem. You know, why does that happen?
Who do you want to talk?
Oh, either I know this is the problem when you have two guests and they're both on the telephone and you can't see them. Yeah, Dr. Conant, you go ahead.
There's a virus called herpes B that's very common in macaques. It doesn't cause them much illness, but if a human gets it, it's fatal. Very serious illness. And for example, smallpox, I briefly want to mention that. I mean, the reason why we were able to eradicate it was that there was no animal reservoir. It only affected humans. Now, we don't know where smallpox came from. It's possible that, during early human history, it might have jumped from animals to humans and then evolved to only infect humans. We don't know. But that's a case where, it just infected humans. Similarly, polio, there's talk about efforts to eradicate polio. Again, as far as I know, there's no animal reservoir for that. It's primarily in humans. Dr. Herman can certainly talk more about the diseases of animals that only infect animals. And I suspect it's primarily a matter of receptors and how the bugs evolve to infect the host that they prefer. And let me just mention that a disease like anthrax, which usually infects cattle and sheep, has been shown in studies that canines such as dogs are relatively resistant to the to infection through aerosolization. So and we don't really understand why.
Yeah, I think it really speaks to the evolutionary biology and the ecology of the infectious agents. Just recently, avian influenza and West Nile virus, of course, have been in the news. And in both of those cases, dogs and cats, just real common domestic species, will seroconvert to West Nile virus and HPAI, but they don't necessarily become clinically ill. It's just how the bug evolved, like Dr. Kahn said.
Mm-hmm. And you pointed to something that's probably worth mentioning here when we're talking about the possibility of diseases moving from other animals to human beings. We're not talking just, people should make sure that we're not talking just about either wild animals or domesticated animals like livestock, like swine and like cattle and sheep. Those things happen, but it is possible for something like this to go from a domestic companion animal, a cat or a dog, or sometimes people do have more exotic animals.
Well, I think the monkeypox outbreak is a great case of that.
Sure.
People in this country, there's a huge market in the importation of these exotic animals, giant Gambian rats and alpacas, animals that ordinarily don't live in the North American continent get imported, and who knows what they harbor. And we don't know if some of these diseases, such as monkeypox, can get transmitted from the animals to humans.
Mm-hmm.
And frequently, if the animals die, it's not really, as with the monkeypox outbreak, if the animals die, there's not really much attention paid to it. But once it starts infecting humans, then then we start paying attention.
Yeah.
So, you know, by then it's late, too late. You know, it's already in the environment. Fortunately, it doesn't appear that monkeypox did get did spread into the general prairie dog population. But if it had, I think it would have been a nightmare.
And probably it's a good idea. We don't want to get people concerned that somehow their dogs or their cats are going to make them sick, because probably that's not going to happen. But at the same time, there might be certain people, particularly people whose immune systems are not working well. There might be concerns there. I wonder if, Dr. Khanna, is it routine as physicians are working with their patients that at some point they might ask them, do you have a dog or a cat or some other kind of animal living with you?
No, it's not a routine question. It's generally not covered. I mean, you know, the organisms are discussed in medical school, but the whole relation between human and animal health is generally not a part of the curriculum. And most physicians do not ask their patients about pet ownership. And, you know, even those who are immunosuppressed, who are at risk, those questions generally are not asked.
Mm-hmm.
So these fall through the cracks, and it's a serious problem.
Let me turn to Dr. Herman. Maybe you just might want to talk a little bit about the maybe what we might call the human-animal interface, and about the fact that greater mobility, having people move into places where they hadn't lived before, in addition to people living closely with around wild animals and with domestic animals, it just seems that the possibility for this kind of transmission is greater now than it has ever been.
Well, certainly on a global scale, there's a lot of change within ecosystems, and right now worldwide there's dramatically increasing demand for animal protein in diets and human diets. And the pressure to produce primarily poultry and swine animal protein has caused a lot of expansion of production systems in Southeast Asia, parts of Africa, Southern Asia, and really requires, according to their production systems, the impingement on natural areas. And so when you start taking down forests to put up animal production units, the animals don't necessarily go away, and you have much more exposure between wild animals and domestic animals. And you're changing the whole ecological interface between livestock production, human interaction, human participation, and the natural ecology of the wildlife. And so that you know, those natural barriers that we have had for years and years, a lot of environments are being broken down by increased demands for production.
Yeah. Let me just quickly here introduce both of our guests. John Herman is a doctor of veterinary medicine here at the College of Vet Medicine at the U of I. He's clinical assistant professor. He's chief of the Food, Animal, Reproduction, Medicine, and Surgery section. He's also director of the DVM MPH program here at the U of I. Also joining us by telephone is Dr. Laura Khan. She is an MD doctor. She's general internist and a member of the research staff of the International She's a member of the a member of the research staff of the Program on Science and Global Security at the Woodrow Wilson School of Public and International Affairs at Princeton. And we're talking about the connections between humans and animals and how sometimes that connection makes possible for diseases to pass between humans and animals, and about how in order to track these kinds of diseases and do what we can to limit their spread, they and others would argue that there have to be better kinds of communication between people who work with humans and people who work with animals, and perhaps also, and I'm sure we'll get to this, better sorts of systems for keeping track of and reporting these kinds of problems, particularly if it falls in one or the other areas of practice. 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. One of the things that I wanted to ask Dr. Khan, mm-hmm. Some of the diseases here that we're talking about are novel, at least in the sense that I would expect that probably a lot of physicians in the United States haven't seen them, even something like, for example, like Lyme disease, mm-hmm. which would make it possible that someone would come in who had Lyme disease, and here you would have a physician who has only ever read about Lyme disease in a book, or, you know, maybe it was the subject of, who knows, in medical school, how much time you spend on things like that. And do we have a problem here in that sometimes physicians simply are having to diagnose things that they have never seen before, and that sometimes makes diagnosis difficult?
Well, certainly. I mean, look at anthrax. During the anthrax attacks of 2001, I mean, there were the cases of inhalational anthrax, and that was diagnosed remarkably quickly because of the they did a spinal tap, and you know, the physician, Dr. Bush, no relation to George, I imagine, noticed them on a stain. But the physicians who saw the patients with cutaneous anthrax or the anthrax that are caused lesions on the skin, none of them recognized it initially as what they were. They were thought primarily to be spider bites or, you know, a variety of other diagnoses. It wasn't until the inhalational cases were announced by the media that the physician started looking at these lesions with a new eye. And then they started thinking maybe this could be cutaneous anthrax. But before the inhalational cases were announced, that was not the case. Hmm. And, you know, there's a saying in medicine, when you hear hoofbeats, you think horses, not zebras. That's certainly the case. I mean, you know, most of the time you'll be right and it'll be a common illness, but once in a while it's not. And it's these uncommon ones that can be a real challenge.
Yeah. Well, and I suppose it's also the cases it's going to have to be something that doctors maybe will be thinking more about. And I know this is a particular interest of yours when it comes to bioterrorism.
Right.
That some of the diseases that might be candidates for use in that way are zoonotic diseases.
That's right.
And this is
one
of them. Yeah. Yeah. So yeah. So that would make it probably even more important for us to have a really high level of awareness about what the symptoms look like, and also some kind of mechanism for trying to track any cases that seem to come up.
Absolutely. I mean, I think the West Nile virus outbreak provides a great example of the critical importance of veterinarians in the community, because for at least a month before the humans became ill, there were sick and dying birds, mostly crows, in that area. And the veterinarians really didn't have, you know, they reported to the state, but the state of New York didn't really have the capability of investigating it. And it really wasn't until the humans started becoming infected that, you know, local public health started paying attention. But then, again, there was no connection between the animals and the humans until Dr. Tracy McNamara, who is a veterinary pathologist at the Bronx Zoo, noticed that some of her birds, her animals, were becoming sick and dying. And she was the one who put two and two together and thought that there must be a link between these two outbreaks.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, it's that's just a great example of the critical link between human and how animals can serve as sentinels for human health problems.
Yeah, I think it seems to me an excellent kind of case study. Maybe there are some others. I don't know, Dr. Herman, is there anything you could add on to that?
I think, yeah, I'd say with West Nile virus, when we first started picking up the first dead birds in 2001 in Illinois, of course, we had the previous experience of New York from the year and two before. And it really pointed out, first of all, of course, we were seeing a lot of dead raptors. I do wildlife rehab on the side, too. So I was seeing a lot of dead owls and hawks and a lot of dead crows and blue jays. In fact, one of them was in my in-law's front yard. It was our first positive in Stevenson County back in 2001. But it also indicated the lack of communication between our laboratory systems. And this is also part of that one medicine concept that we're folding together. We have the State Public Health Lab up in Chicago. We have the University of Illinois Diagnostic Lab. And we have three regional state labs at Galesburg, Centralia, and Springfield. And at that time, there was no MOUs between memorandums of understandings between the lab to accept dead animals, dead crows especially, for West Nile virus diagnosis. And so the Chicago lab was so overwhelmed, the surge capacity, they couldn't handle at all, yet the other four labs couldn't run the test, even though they had the expertise and the capability to do so. And it's that kind of lack of communication when we're all talking about the same thing that we really, really need to improve on.
Yeah. This is something that I think is really interesting, and I'd like to have you both talk a little bit more about it. And I guess let me stay with Dr. Herman with this one medicine concept. And I know you have written about it, and that was a basic idea underlying this conference that you both were involved in that took place at the earlier in the month, on the 9th and the 10th. This idea that if you do go back in the history of medicine, you might have to go back a few hundred years, but that's in human history, that's not all that far. You go back to this point where there wasn't such a clear distinction between human medicine and other animal medicine, and that you're making this argument that at least in when it comes to these kind of diseases that we're talking about, diseases that can be transmitted from animals to humans, that it would be a good idea for us to go back and cultivate some of that kind of relationship, at least when it comes to people who practice human medicine and people who practice animal medicine having better kinds of communication.
I don't think there's any doubt about that, especially, you know, it even comes down to dollars. With most of our federal dollar being spent elsewhere and our budget being basically frozen in a deficit mode right now, we really need to share our capacities. We need to share our intellectual capacities, our lab capacities, our research capacities. It's an economic and a health necessity as well.
One thing that I'd like to point out is that while there are 125 accredited medical schools in this country, there are only 28 accredited schools of veterinary medicine. That's about a 4.5-fold difference between them. And also, most of the veterinary colleges are located in rural settings, whereas medical schools are in urban settings. And University of Illinois has the advantage in that they have both a medical and a veterinary medical school on the same campus, which facilitates collaboration. But, you know, not all institutions have that advantage, which makes collaborative efforts more of a challenge.
Mm-hmm. Well, I could imagine some people saying, on the one hand, they would say, yes, we recognize the fact that humans are animals, you know, so we got dogs and cats and humans. Well, we're all animals. But at the same time, they would say, isn't the province of the MD very different from the DVM? And the idea that if there's really one medicine, I'm sure some people would sort of scratch their heads and say, well, really, what are you talking about? Because isn't people medicine different from dog and cat medicine?
Well, yeah, but you have to realize that the bugs don't see much difference. You know, we might see a difference, but the pathogens, the viruses and the bacteria, they might not see a difference.
Mm-hmm. So, you know, go ahead, Laura. Sorry.
Yeah, no, I was just going to say that, you know, it depends on whose perspective you're talking about.
Right.
You know, I come from a private practice background, and when I got out of Illinois in 1978 and went into private practice, I was really maybe not surprised, but just kind of amused by the fact that people just are just amazed that we use the same antibiotic for their dog as cat as you do for their own kid or for themselves. But like Dr. Khan said, the bacteria doesn't know that. You know, they don't know who the host is, and the antibiotics work no matter who you put it into, as long as you don't abuse them. You know, it really is. We were talking about one medicine versus one health, and probably you could use the terms interchangeably, but we're really talking about the same system, same animal systems.
Yeah. Well, maybe we're at our midpoint here, and maybe for the benefit of anybody who might have just tuned in, I should introduce again our guests and the topic that we're discussing. Here we're talking about the interface between humans and animals and how that involves public health. And the reason that is important is, as I said at the beginning of the program, we have a lot of diseases, and some of them are infectious diseases that we're really concerned about now in the world. A lot of these are diseases that can be passed from animals to humans. And the argument is that makes it really important that there be kind of connections and communications between the two kind of doctors, those who treat human beings and those who treat other animals. And when one of them sees a particular kind of problem, there ought to be some kind of central database, and we can talk more about this, for them to report to when, for example, we have a case like West Nile where birds are dying, and that ought to be a signal that there is a disease there and that it can potentially affect human beings. And of course, as we know, it did go on to affect human beings. And we have two guests with us. They're both here on the telephone. Dr. John Herman, he's a doctor of veterinary medicine here at the U of I. He's a graduate of the U of I. As he said, after graduating, he worked in private practice and worked in areas like dairy herd health and small animal medicine and wildlife rehabilitation. Then he became a faculty member here at the U of I in 2004, and he is currently the guy who developed and directs the DVM-MPH, so that's Doctor of Veterinary Medicine, Master Public Health Program in the College of Vet Medicine. He's also clinical assistant professor here. And our other guest is Dr. Laura Kahn. She is an MD doctor. She's an internist. She is a member of the research staff of the Program on Science and Global Security at the Woodrow Wilson School of Public and International Affairs at Princeton. She got her MD degree from Mount Sinai School of Medicine and also has a Master Public Health from Columbia and Master Public Policy from Princeton. And she's done a number of other things in her career. And one of the things, as I mentioned, that she's particularly interested in is bioterrorism. And the diseases that we're talking about here are definitely ones that you have to be concerned about as agents that could be employed in bioterrorism. Questions are welcome. 333-9455, toll free, 800-222-9455. One thing I wanted to ask here, Dr. Herman, I think something that is happening within the field of vet education is that the demand for various kinds of vets has changed, or at least in the sense that we have a lot of people who have dogs and cats, but not that many people anymore who have cattle and horses. And so the demand is for small animal vets who would work with companion animals. And are we having a problem that we're not training enough vets who work with large animals or exotics or wild animals?
Yeah, I think there's a definite need there. There's probably the two greatest needs within veterinary medicine as far as job descriptions are production medicine or food supply veterinarians, either in private practice, working with large dairies, large hog operations, poultry producers, beef, or a production supply or supply side veterinarians in working for regulatory agencies such as USDA and FDA. And then the other area of critical need is public health. We have an incredible workforce shortage in nationally in public health. There's a statistic, I probably ought to know this, but off the top of my head, but it's something like some incredible percentage of public health professionals are due to retire within the next 5 years nationally. And maybe Dr. Kahn can help me out with that exact number, but we really need to restaff our public health workforce with both physicians and veterinarians.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, there's the number of physicians going into public health has really been dropping over the years, and I think largely due to a decrease in funding. You know, the salaries in public health just don't compare in a private sector or in industry. So you see a real drain in the number of people going into it.
Yeah.
It's a serious problem.
Well, I think this is an interesting point. That is the importance of public health and the fact that we don't give it the kind of priority that perhaps we should. This is, in a sense, a side issue, but I was really struck the other day reading, and I'm sure you read about this, that the British Medical Journal, they did a survey of their members or subscribers, and they said the journal first came out in 1840, and so they said to them, okay, what do you think was the most important, the biggest medical advance that has happened since 1840? And interestingly enough, the thing that they came up with was sanitation.
Yep.
It wasn't antibiotics. It wasn't anesthesia, although those things are important. It wasn't any of this modern medical technology that we have. It wasn't MRIs. But that what it gets you thinking is just how important to human health, say, access to clean water is, and being able to get our waste taken care of and keep that from separate from the water, that it represented a huge advance in human health, and it had nothing to do with these other kinds of medical, as good and as important that they are, with these other kinds of medical technologies. And I think that's something that's worth thinking about and reminding people of such a basic thing like that, and how important that was to eliminating the spread of disease.
Yeah, absolutely. I'm glad you pointed that out. In fact, the life expectancy started going up, you know, at the turn of the last century because of sanitation. It was increasing long before antibiotics came on the scene, and it's purely because, you know, you got rid of the waste and the opportunity for infection was decreasing. Unfortunately, I mean, antibiotics were terrific, but once they became known, we started relying on them too much. They became the magic bullet. And as useful as they are, in some ways I think we over-rely on them, and now we're seeing resistance. So, it's a serious problem.
David, you bring up a real good point, and Laura confirms it. In 1900, the average life expectancy for people at birth was 43 years, and at the turn of the century in 1999, it was 73. So we picked up 30 years life expectancy at birth in 100 years. And the experts say that 25 of those 30-year increase in life expectancy was due to public health interventions, as you were just saying, sanitation, basic hygiene, food safety, cooling, refrigeration, all those types of really, really basic public health initiatives.
Yeah. And it all, of course, we still have to remind ourselves that we still do have serious problems with foodborne disease that ultimately may indeed have to do with the problem of animal waste in the environment. So we've got salmonella, we've got E. coli, and just not all within the past 6-8 months, we've certainly seen examples of that. And then there are certainly still examples of disease that's spread through poor sanitation and bad water, you know, typhus and cholera, and I don't know how many different diseases like that there are. So those continue still to be a serious problem, both of them.
Yeah, absolutely. And it's on a global level. I mean, you know, in much of the world, there is no, clean water or good sanitation. And, I spent 6 months living in Chile about 2 years ago. And, everybody just washed their vegetables in detergent, you know, before fruits and vegetables, tomatoes were peeled. Nobody would order a salad at a restaurant. And those are the kinds of things that, you know, we just don't think about in this country. But yet, you know, our food supply is increasingly global. So here you buy a bag of grapes from Chile. When I was living in Chile, I would wash them fanatically with detergent. And here I just rinse them off and eat them and serve them to the kids, you know, because you just think, oh, well, it's the United States. It's clean. But, you know, it's the same grapes. We have to start rethinking about how we approach our global food supply because it's, it's going to be increasingly difficult to, I think, oversee, food safety with all these interconnected networks of food.
You know, I was at a conference at University of Pennsylvania in November, big international conference on livestock, revolution, public health, veterinary medicine, human medicine. There were representatives there from the World Bank, from the Food and Agriculture Organization, from the UN, and WHO, World Health Organization. You talk about a crying need for technical expertise, especially from physicians and veterinarians. They were just basically begging us to produce more veterinarians and physicians who would be interested in global health, international health initiatives.
We have a couple of callers. Why don't we bring them into the conversation? We'll start with someone in Champaign, and they are on line one. Hello.
Hello. Good morning.
Uh-huh.
I was wondering, they were talking about the relationship of humans and animals and the transmittal of disease, transmission of disease. I live in a neighborhood in Champaign that has a lot of retaining pools and a lot of geese in the summer. And the geese do not just stay in the retaining pools, but they walk around in big groups, maybe 12 to 20, all through the neighborhood. And remembered all the problems with West Nile disease, the bird-human interaction, and how much Champaign County had a problem of West Nile disease concentrated incidences concentrated in Champaign County. And I was wondering, you know, should we in the neighborhood be concerned, you know, that the geese, you know, walk around in such large packs, drop their waste, you know, stop traffic. Traffic's not the problem. It's just the presence of such a large animal contingent in a neighborhood. You know, is that something to be concerned about? And should I be talking to my city council about restraining the amount of geese that come here and spend the summer and then go elsewhere for the winter?
You know, the caller brings up two really good points. One is about climate change. You know, when I was a kid, we never used to see Canada geese in Illinois, except once in a while in the winter.
Mm-hmm.
But because everything is, the warmth is, our winters aren't as cold, you know, they become resident population now. The other thing about West Nile virus is a vector transmitted disease, and I'm not real sure that geese even serve as a reservoir for West Nile. So the main thing with West Nile is decreasing exposure to infected mosquitoes.
Uh-huh. Also, in terms of bioterrorism, you know, can these, you know, should we be removing this kind of wildlife from a settled neighborhood?
You mean cull them? I actually think that animals serve as an important sentinel for any kind of potential bioterrorist attack, assuming that the release is aerial rather than, say, through envelopes. So I think animals are extremely important in the early detection of something like that.
Well, I was, you know, listening to all the information about bird flu, the bird flu, the Asian bird flu that they're concerned about, you know, not spreading to other parts of the world. And would ducks and geese be a reservoir for such things if it were to be transferred here?
They certainly could be. In fact, ducks and geese have been recognized as a migratory reservoir. The thing to remember about avian flu is we haven't diagnosed it in North America yet. Mm-hmm. And so it's something to really pay attention to, but at this point in time, I wouldn't lose any sleep over it. Just make sure you pick up as much information as you can. If we do see it on the East Coast or West Coast or even in the Midwest coming up through a flyway, we'll certainly have to deal with our resident population of ducks and geese.
Okay.
I think one thing that I would just like to mention is that influenza is just part of life on this planet, I mean,
mm-hmm.
just as hurricanes are. So, I mean, you don't want to depopulate the entire planet of all the wildlife in the hopes of reducing the risk of an influenza pandemic because just, you know, they're the reservoir of it, and we just have to learn how to best handle it.
Yeah.
But, you know, just as we track hurricanes through satellites, we need to develop the biological equivalent of a satellite to monitor it and prepare, just as they do with hurricanes.
Yeah. Well, it's something else that the caller, the story raises in my mind, the fact that, and it's something that I think will increasingly become a fact of life in a lot of cities, that as cities grow, and here we head in Champaign-Urbana, we have a sort of a medium-sized town that's surrounded by farmland. And the cities continue to grow. We're encroaching further and further into the surrounding rural area and into what is the territory of wild animals. And as that happens, we should not be surprised that in residential areas, and I think we've started to see it, and I'm sure that we're going to see it more and more, that we're going to see more animals than we have not seen before. We are already seeing various kinds of birds that maybe we haven't seen so much in residential areas before, and it wouldn't surprise me if we're going to start to see more deer and coyotes and fox and who knows what all else, because we're moving into their territory, and they have no choice but to, if they can, to try to adapt to living around us.
I think that's right, David, and also we're our demographics have changed so much in the last 50 years or so. We've gotten so far away from our rural roots, our agricultural roots. And I'm thinking primarily about hunting. When I was a kid and we'd go out hunting, you took it for granted that there were certain parts of the rabbit that you stayed away from. You know, because of, so we didn't know it at the time what the bacteria was. It's Yersinia, but it's Sylvatic plague. And anymore, we have kind of like a naive population who haven't been out on farms. You could live your whole life and never be on a farm anymore. We have a whole population who never go out fishing and hunting and get exposed to wildlife and know from maybe just cultural upbringing on how to avoid illnesses that our forefathers took for granted 100 years ago.
Yeah, I think something like 2% of the population in this country now works in agriculture, and it was something like 20% or even more at the turn of the last century. I mean, it's just a huge drop in the number of people working in agriculture. But you're absolutely right. I mean, as the human population grows, I think globally we're now at 5 or 6 billion, and we're projected to go up to, 11 billion in the next decades. I mean, we can anticipate that as cities grow in density, deforestation, destruction of the environment, we're going to see a lot more of these diseases emerge. And we're going to have to learn how to deal with it, and I think one medicine is one of the best ways to do that.
We have about 10 minutes left, and we have another caller I need to get right to. Let me just introduce again our guest. The last person you heard is Dr. Laura Kahn. She is an MD doctor. She's an internist, and she's also a member of the research staff of the Program on Science and Global Security at the Woodrow Wilson School of Public and International Affairs at Princeton. Also joining us is Dr. John Herman. He's a doctor of veterinary medicine, clinical assistant professor here at the U of I in the College of Vet Medicine. We're talking about the interface between humans and animals, the fact that there are diseases that can be passed from animals to humans, and the fact that means that it's important for there to be some close collaboration, communication between the various kinds of doctors, those who deal with humans and those who deal with other animals. Questions welcome. 333-9455, toll free 800-222-9455. The next caller is Urbana, line 2. Hello.
I heard you mentioning a dirty word, according to some people, and that's evolution and evolve. You know, you're talking about it happening now and continuing to happen, and understanding how diseases change based on our understanding of how evolution works. And yet we have a huge portion of our population who don't believe that evolution is a rational explanation for what is going on. And we have, what really concerns me is that we have religious fundamentalists affecting science and in our country with regard to understanding scientific processes. We seem to have an anti-science bias in a major portion of the population and in the current administration. And then the other thing that worries me is this whole increasing number of people who believe that the end times are coming and that the rapture is coming, and that all the people who believe in Jesus Christ are going to be saved and the rest of everybody else is just going to go to pot. And they see they see the wars in the Middle East, and they see terrorism, and they see disease as signs that the end times are coming. So they're not going to do anything about it. In fact, they seem to feel as though, you know, why not contribute to it and get it over with? Sort of mentality, and it really, really worries me, because not only, we're not just talking about small cults, we're talking about, well, there was just a story in on NPR, was it today or yesterday, about how books about the Left Behind series and so forth are bestsellers, and that Walmart is asking for more of these kinds of books. So all those things have to be affecting science, and in addition to all the things that you're talking about.
Well, let's get some comment. I don't know if either of you want to get into any of that. What do you think?
Well, I'll just say that I agree. I share her concerns that you know, that if you don't agree with the theory of evolution, then addressing these challenges will be a lot more difficult, because, you know, the scientific evidence is very strong supporting it. And in order to adequately address these emerging infectious diseases, we have to look at it through the lens of evolution in order to address them. So her concerns are valid, and I share them, and I'll just leave it at that.
I had the opportunity and the honor to serve in the U.S. Senate in 03 and 04 as a congressional science advisor with our own Senator Durbin, by the way. And in my tenure there, it was a weekly battle to try to get the ideology out of science policy. And I can't say what it was like with previous administrations, but all I can say is for that year plus that I was there, that was a real struggle. That was a struggle every day. And, you know, in science policy, we try to infuse it with best evidence, whether it's public health, human health, animal health. We try to go on best evidence. And when you have made a pact with some ideological base and you're in the executive branch of the government, you can really, really force your will on policy.
All right. Well, let's talk with someone else. Chicago, I think, next. Line 4. Hello.
Thank you. In Chicago, Dr. Quinton Young is a great advocate of the necessity of increasing and expanding the area of public health, but the funding has been somewhat diminished, as I understand. However, to be more specific in the area of health, way back when there were some listeria outbreaks in the areas of the East Coast and other outbreaks there, it's leading on to what I've heard other things are occurring that we may not recognize so openly. There's hormone disruptors and other things that could be contributing to health decline and so forth. I was wondering if you could comment briefly somewhat about the funding as well as the necessity to increase that and the hidden dangers of these hormone disruptors on our health. Thank you.
Funding for public health has declined over the past at least 30 years. It's really at this point at kind of skeletal. I mean, there's no fat to cut. Since the anthrax attacks, there has been an infusion of federal funds to improve it, but unfortunately it's primarily Band-Aids to try and help the crumbling infrastructure. And a lot of it is just kind of zero-sum game because the states are looking, well, we're getting federal funds, so we don't have to put in our share. So, and in addition, public health is being asked to expand its mandate beyond what it's been minimally funded to do. So, you know, we really, if we were serious, you know, we would look long and hard at how it's being funded and, you know, and make some hard decisions and changes. For example, here in New Jersey, we have an infrastructure that, you know, we've got over 115 health departments in 21 counties, and most of them are just too small to really adequately address some of the challenges that we face in the 21st century. But, you know, the funding is tight, and, you know, and it's hard to make the kind of changes that are needed to do, hard to make the political decisions, the necessary political changes to improve it. So, you know, we have a real uphill battle ahead of us if we want to improve it. And in terms of endocrine disruptors, I'm not really familiar with, I mean, I haven't really focused on that, and I don't really feel comfortable discussing it, but, you know, there have been concerns about, you know, endocrine disruptors in the food supply, but I'm not really aware of any solid scientific evidence suggesting that.
We're almost out of time. I just want to very quickly, and fortunately it's going to have to be brief, raise this question about, going back to this, the subject we started talking about, the fact that there doesn't seem to be any central national data bank that maybe veterinarians certainly could report to, but maybe other doctors could report to, so that we can gather data together and be a little bit better at tracking these kind of diseases that we're talking about, those that go from animals to humans. Is that right, that there really isn't anything like that?
There's multiple systems, but they don't necessarily all talk to each other. Mm. At the U of I campus in, what was it, October or so, at the NCSA, we had a meeting about public health informatics and medical informatics. And you have software systems that just don't communicate to each other. And there's some proprietary issues, there's some privacy issues with HIPAA and some other factors that come into play. But, yeah, that is a real major problem, trying to share data.
Yeah, the CDC collects data from all the states, but the collection is voluntary, and each state has a different list of what data they collect. And, you know, most of them focus primarily on human, although there are they do collect data on human rabies, and I believe also animal rabies as well. But it's very select. I mean, West Nile virus is one of the few cases where there is a national system set up looking at both human and animal cases, but it's unfortunately the exception rather than the rule.
Well, I think that we're just about at the point where we're going to have to finish, and I'm sure that there are some other things that we could talk about, but maybe this is something that we'll get back to. I expect we probably get back to on another day, because these kinds of things, these diseases that we're talking about are not going to be going away, that's for sure. So we will leave it at that with our thanks to Dr. Laura Kahn. She is a general internist and a member of the research staff of the Program on Science and Global Security at the Woodrow Wilson School of Public and International Affairs at Princeton. Dr. Kahn, thank you very much.
My pleasure. Thank you for having me.
And Dr. John Herman, he's clinical assistant professor here at the U of I in the College of Veterinary Medicine. He's chief of the Food, Animal Reproduction, Medicine, and Surgery section, and also director of the Doctor of Veterinary Medicine Master Public Health Program. And Dr. Herman, thank you very much.
Thank you, David.